us. We need help. Terry Taylor, Booking Committee Member, 1997. Chapter 3, 1997, The Waiting Game. If 1996 taught Eric Bischoff anything, it was that the New World Order was the future of his company. That much was made clear from the ratings and the buy rates, both of which had skyrocketed following the launch of The Angle. The numbers did not lie. Attendance was up 43% over 1995, gates were up 87%, and buy rates for pay-per-views, where the company made the bulk of its money, were closing in on that. In fact, the very first Nitro of 1997 drew 10,034 paid, a brand new record. And this came a week before the Chicago show shattered that number, with over 17,000 fans paying $189,206. The NWO had brought them to the Holy Land, and nowhere else would the spotlight shine brighter than this. No longer was WCW beneath Vince McMahon's mighty World Wrestling Federation. No, now they were on more or less equal ground, and having come this far, there was no way they were turning back. Although the New World Order was a strong contingent, the fact remained that they were a bunch of bad guys. And in wrestling, bad guys are only draws if they have a strong babyface to confront them. Although the rest of WCW was often made out as a bunch of buffoons, one guy had not yet been booked to look like a total idiot. Sting. The man who had been the franchise of the company from almost the moment it became WCW, Sting was viewed by fans as the one guy within WCW who could conceivably compete with and defeat these invaders. To Bischoff's credit, he knew that in order to maximize revenue from the inevitable battle between Sting and Hogan, this could be no ordinary feud. In those days, feuds generally played out over a couple of months. The plan was to make this one of the slowest building feuds ever, a long, drawn-out affair lasting over a year. By building the feud up to December's Starrcade, WCW's biggest show of the year, fans would be lined up to pay to finally see Sting take down Hogan. The only remaining question was whether Bischoff would actually stick to his guns and keep Sting out of action for 12 months, or if he'd get antsy for the big payday and rush the match to pay-per-view. In order to allow the matchup he wanted, Bischoff felt he had to focus the company almost entirely on the New World Order. Never was Bischoff's game plan more obvious than during the first pay-per-view of the year, sold out, or, to be more precise, NWO sold out. This show was designed to be a showcase for the group. It wasn't promoted on air as a WCW event, but as a New World Order event in which WCW wrestlers would show up and get their asses kicked. The idea was to see if a pay-per-view could be marketed and successfully sold solely under the New World Order name. If this could be done, it stood to reason that at some point in the future, Bischoff could begin to run more than one pay-per-view a month, thereby doubling the revenue these events generated. It seemed well worth the gamble to give it a try. The show opened in a manner most bizarre, as Bischoff, Sean Waltman, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and the rest of the group circled the arena riding atop garbage trucks. Say what you want about them, but even the most jaded skeptic has to give Bischoff points for originality. Certainly, no pay-per-view in the history of pro wrestling had begun in such a manner. Even the set pieces on the show were unique. The standard bright and gaudy WCW sets were vacant, and in their place was a dark, industrial look from which it appeared no color could escape. The entrance was black, the ring apron was black, the ropes were black, and the turnbuckles were black. Aside from a few white NWO logos splashed around the arena, everything was black. In addition, the group's trademark camera tricks were in full effect, with static blacking out the camera at random intervals. The bizarre camera angles likely had first-time viewers wondering if they were watching wrestling or an old episode of the 60s Batman TV show. It was totally bizarre and completely different from anything else the wrestling world had ever seen. This was definitely not your ordinary, run-of-the-mill wrestling pay-per-view event. This was new. This was different. This was a New World Order pay-per-view. If anyone needed evidence that the NWO was starting to become severely watered down at this point, they need look no further than the NWO sold-out pay-per-view. Hogan, Hall, and Nash, the original nucleus of the group, had been joined by Waltman, DiBiase, and Bischoff shortly thereafter. Rounding out the ranks were Buff Bagwell, Scott Norton, Masahiro Chono, Mike Virgil/Vincent Jones, Ray Traylor, Elizabeth, a fake Sting, and about 20 other scrubs, all of whom tried to push each other out of the way in a vain attempt to occupy more of the television screen. It was almost an omen of what would come later in the year. In addition to the matches, the show also featured a Miss NWO contest, as middle-aged women straddling Harley-Davidson motorcycles proclaimed their love to the New World Order. It was neither erotic nor comical, but more like what would happen if your mom had a pageant with her friends, and they all said they wanted to grope Kevin Nash. Doesn't sound like a good time, does it? The fans in the arena weren't amused and immediately began to chant boring, as Bischoff himself began to mack with the skag biker chicks on stage. In between his makeout sessions with the skanks, Bischoff, taking center stage on a podium above the entrance ramp, began to preach the message of the New World Order to the crowd. His statement was clear. WCW sucks. It was a familiar rallying cry, one that was repeated over and over again to the point that no one watching the show could miss it. And even if they did ignore Bischoff's rantings, the presentation of WCW at the event would certainly sway their opinion. The WCW wrestlers who were not on the show were shown sitting in the crowd like common fans, a band of outcasts who couldn't cut it with Bischoff's rogue coalition. Even the handful of WCW wrestlers who participated in the show looked like losers. They had no music, no pyro, and they were introduced by a monotone voice in a very mocking manner. The NWO, meanwhile, were given grand entrances with music and lighting as the announcer declared their superiority. The point was clear. The WCW guys were pathetic, and they were no match for the New World Order. Despite the fact that the angle had given the promotion new life, the fact remained that the New World Order, as cool and hip as they might be, were supposed to be the bad guys in the story. All the mockery of WCW seemed to sap the very life out of the crowd, as they sat quietly through the majority of the show, seeming neither upset nor particularly thrilled by the outcome of any of the matches. Of course, those outcomes involved the New World Order winning almost every bout, generally with the help of evil referee Nick Patrick. The few wins WCW was able to rack up were generally due to match stipulations in which the referee didn't come into play, such as a ladder match in which Eddie Guerrero, billed as the Mexican Jumping Bean by the ring announcer, a line that surely wouldn't offend anyone, was able to yank down the U.S. heavyweight belt suspended above the ring. The atrocious main event saw yet another NWO debacle, as Hulk Hogan pinned the Giant, who had joined and then left the group in the span of less than 6 months, following a beatdown by nearly every member of the group. Was the sold-out experiment a success? In a word, no. The buy rate was a mere 0.47, the lowest since the start of the New World Order angle. The show took place in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, before a crowd of around 5,000, yet another sellout, but since the building was so small, the take was under $70,000 and a major disappointment. In short, everything was about half of what the previous pay-per-view, Starrcade 1996, had generated. The company decided to go back to the successful Starrcade formula for the next show, Super Brawl 7, this time pitting Hogan against Piper in what was very clearly billed as a world title match. To promote the event, Piper was filmed in a bizarre series of vignettes in which he was locked away inside Alcatraz. Following the conclusion of the main event, fans probably wished that they too had been locked in solitary confinement. To be fair, however, the company had once again gone back to the blueprint they had followed to make Nitro a must-see show. They'd feature great matches prior to the blockbuster show-selling, albeit generally bad, main events. Bouts featuring men like Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero, Sean Waltman, and Chris Jericho opened the show, bringing the fans to life. The undercard was as solid as ever, due primarily to the fact that Bischoff continued to spare no expense when it came to bringing in talent. Through raids of either the WWF, ECW, or Japan, Bischoff had brought in an amazing array of outstanding talent from around the globe. From 1996 to 1997, newcomers like Jericho, Juventud Guerrera, Rey Mysterio Jr., and countless others tore up the ring. WCW would need the fresh young talent, as it was slowly becoming apparent to everyone, save those in charge, that guys like Hogan and Piper just couldn't deliver in the ring as they once could. Try as they might, the two stumbled through yet another horrible main event. This time, Piper once again appeared to win the belt, but this was overturned when Randy Savage turned his back on WCW and put Hogan's foot under the rope, thus negating the title change. As all this was going on, Sting just watched silently from down the entrance ramp, then slowly turned and walked away. The slow burn would continue. Despite the bad main event, the show was able to rebound slightly from the depths to which Sold Out had taken the company, scoring a 0.75 buy rate and drawing almost $200,000 at the door from the 13,324 in attendance. It was a move in the right direction. WCW immediately took that money and spent it, announcing that they had just signed a huge star for Uncensored, their next pay-per-view. Dennis Rodman. It didn't matter that Rodman wouldn't be able to actually wrestle on the show due to the fact that it was in the middle of the NBA season. Bischoff knew that with the media covering the basketball bad boy at his every turn, WCW could get instant exposure, and a ton of it, if he could somehow sign him to do a couple of shows. It was also rumored that Vince McMahon was looking to do the same, so it should come as no surprise that Bischoff was willing to do anything to once again stick it to Vince and the WWF. McMahon had offered the Worm $1 million for two dates, so Bischoff outbid him to the tune of nearly $2 million for three dates. Uncensored once again epitomized the company at the time, with young guys like Ultimo Dragon coming in for great matches with Mexican luchadores like Psicosis. For once, though, the main event of the evening was actually pretty good, largely due to the fact that they crammed nine guys into the ring in a three-way, which the NWO obviously won, when Rodman and Savage interfered. In the storylines, this win gave Hogan's organization the right to challenge for any title anytime they so desired. However, as the group celebrated, Sting rappelled from the ceiling, baseball bat in hand, and lay absolute waste to Nash, Hall, and Savage. As the crowd went nuts, Sting slowly raised his bat and pointed it at his target, Hogan. Finally, Hogan got into the ring, and Sting obliterated him as well. It was unquestionably the biggest response any WCW star had gotten since the birth of the New World Order, and it seemed impossible to believe that Bischoff could hold off on delivering this match on pay-per-view for another 9 months. The buy rate, though, showed that Bischoff was on the right track, as it wound up at just under 0.9, which WCW trumpeted far and wide as having beaten that year's WrestleMania, which scored a 0.77. It was apparent that Bischoff could and would hold off, as the following pay-per-view, Spring Stampede, featured neither Sting nor Hogan. Instead, the main event was a showdown between Savage and Diamond Dallas Page. The event was largely forgettable and largely unwatched, drawing a low 0.58 buy rate. However, even with a weak lineup, the company was still hot enough that it sold out in advance, drawing 8,356 fans paying $107,115. Indeed, selling out shows in advance was becoming a trend. A trend, ironically, that would end up hurting the company in the long run. To his credit, Bischoff didn't panic and hotshot the Sting-Hogan showdown at the next show. Instead, he continued to do nitros in which Sting would silently and methodically stalk Hogan and the New World Order from the rafters. In a business that is well known for getting the big payday as quickly as possible, it is absolutely amazing that Bischoff stayed his course. Indeed, even after the next show, Slamboree did a similar 0.60 buy rate, as did the follow-up to that, Great American Bash, Bischoff was resolute in his plan. In short, his was precisely the type of patience the company would not show in subsequent years, and this would eventually cost him dearly. By this point, business was really starting to pick up. Tickets went on sale in April for the June 9 Nitro at the Fleet Center in Boston, and set a new first-day record with 10,000 sold for $170,000. House show business was also through the roof. In fact, By mid-1997, they were doing triple the business they had done in 1995. It didn't seem to matter what anyone did. Everything the company touched was turning to gold. One of the primary reasons that WCW house show business was so hot at the time was due to the awesome work of Zane Bresloff. Bresloff not only promoted WCW events, he was also the man behind the promotion of WrestleMania III, for which the WWF claimed to have jammed 93,173 fans into the Pontiac Silverdome. Years later, Bresloff himself would admit that the actual number was 78,000. The next show featuring Hogan was Bash at the Beach, which had become something of a gala event for WCW. Hogan had not only made his debut at Bash at the Beach in 1994, but he'd also done the legendary heel turn to form the New World Order there in 1996. The 1997 version of the show was also going to give the fans something memorable, as Dennis Rodman would not only be present at the event, but wrestle as well. Because basketball season was over, the Worm now had the green light to actually get in the ring, and he would team up with Hogan to take on WCW mainstays Lex Luger and the Giant. WCW certainly couldn't be blamed for focusing the promotion of the event on the Rodman match, as he was all over the place in 1997. He had just won the second of three consecutive NBA world titles with Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. He was just about to release a best-selling autobiography, Bad as I Want to Be, and he was a constant media magnet due to his bizarre behavior both on and off the court. In short, Dennis Rodman was a hot property. A hot property and, because of his real athletic ability, Rodman was a surprisingly decent wrestler in his very first real match. Some even went as far as to call him the best wrestler of the four that evening. This was not high praise. The other three in the tag match were Hogan, the Giant, and Lex Luger. Hogan did most of the in-ring work, if you can call stalling for the first 5 minutes of the showdown work. After about 7 minutes, Hogan finally tagged in Rodman, and the crowd held its breath to see just what the Worm would bring to the table. Rodman strutted around the ring, sunglasses on, and eventually locked up with Luger. And then it happened. He arm-dragged Luger. Yes. He was able to execute one of the most basic maneuvers in the history of pro wrestling. The announcers went hysterical, acting as though a successor to Frank A. Gotch himself had finally been discovered. Rodman posed for the crowd, took off his sunglasses, polished them, and then put them right back on. Fortunately for WCW, Luger was somehow able to regain his breath and not only arm-drag Rodman twice, but also Hogan twice for good measure as well. The pro WCW announce team celebrated, proclaiming, "Welcome to WCW, where the big boys play." Hogan and Rodman weren't foiled yet, however. Rodman once again locked up with Luger and threw him into the ropes. As Luger came toward him, Rodman, get this, leapfrogged him. Though this exact same sequence of maneuvers had been done in almost every single match of the last 20 years, the announce team nearly had a heart attack. "That's no rookie we're watching. He's been tutored by the best." Tony Schiavone even claimed that Rodman was showing, and this is a quote, "flashes of brilliance." Despite the brilliance of such high-impact moves as leapfrogs and arm drags, the NWO was defeated when Luger managed to get a submission win over Hogan. Although the Rodman match was a total and complete fiasco from a technical wrestling standpoint, the show did a decent number, a 0.78 with a $150,870 gate. It wasn't the number that WCW was hoping for, but the momentum was definitely building. The ratings for Nitro continued to move upwards as Luger's chase for Hogan's championship took center stage. The night after Bash at the Beach, Nitro scored a 3.5 rating. 3 weeks of promotion later, a 3-hour Nitro special, it was the 100th episode, scored a whopping 4.34, and the title bout, in which Luger dethroned Hogan, scored an amazing, for the time at least, 5.2 rating. Obviously, the success of the show inspired Bischoff to present more 3-hour programs in the future. The Luger win set the stage for the next pay-per-view, August's Road Wild, A lawsuit filed by Harley-Davidson forced them to drop the hog, the annual money pit from Sturgis, South Dakota. Not only did the event once again produce its famed $0 gate, it also had to be somewhat of a disappointment, as the buy rate came in at 0.65. This was well below expectations, especially since the Luger-Hogan feud had been generating such good numbers in the Monday night ratings. But there may have been an even more damaging effect on the company in this show, although one much less noticeable than could be computed by tallying gate receipts and buy rate numbers. This was a simple fact that when push came to shove in big matches, the New World Order never lost. At Road Wild, this was proven during the Steiners versus Outsiders match for the World Tag Team Championships. The Steiners had been around WCW for years, and even though they'd had a brief run in the WWF, they were considered true home team talent. The pair had been babyfaces during their entire time as a tag team, and so they, along with Sting, were seen as the saviors of the company. The number of wrestlers that fans bought as being on equal ground with the New World Order was slim, with only Luger, Sting, the Steiners, and maybe the Giant viewed as guys who could legitimately hang with Hogan and his cronies. In order for this belief to be perpetuated, however, these men eventually had to be given wins over their adversaries. In Luger's case, such a win happened, albeit very briefly. The Steiners didn't even get that much. Despite the fact that they had been chasing Hall and Nash for almost a year, they left Road Wild without the tag belts yet again. Keep in mind that not only had they been feuding with Hall and Nash all this time, there was even a vignette filmed in which the evil duo ran the Steiners' car off a road. Rick and Scott didn't file charges, because in the wacky world of pro wrestling, the only way to get true revenge for attempted vehicular manslaughter is to take your opponent's title belt. The Steiners were scheduled to take the belts, but in the end, it didn't happen. Hall and Nash went up to Bischoff backstage at the pay-per-view and said the frequent title changes were hurting the drawing power of the belts. Therefore, they argued, they should retain against the Steiners. Bischoff assented. The irony of all of this was that Luger, who had just won the WCW title 6 days earlier at Nitro, didn't get to retain and drop the belt instead to Hall and Nash's good buddy, Hulk Hogan. The next night on Nitro, Luger was hardly mentioned at all. This upset more than a few of the boys in the back. It wasn't just Luger and the Steiners. Others were being held down as well. The Four Horsemen, led by Ric Flair, the man many fans considered to be the very epitome of WCW, were also made to look bad at every opportunity. Despite having been made out as Hogan's whipping boy since his 1994 arrival at WCW, Flair still commanded the respect of many loyal WCW fans, specifically in the Carolinas, a longtime hotbed for the company. Hogan and Nash didn't particularly care for Flair or the reaction he was garnering from the crowds there, so at seemingly every live Nitro that took place in the region, they would take shots at Flair and how old he was, or better yet, they'd simply leave him lying in a broken heap. To make a long story short, since Hogan, Nash, and Hall basically had total say on their characters, Hogan had complete creative control written into his contract, they made Flair look like an idiot, time and time again, in front of his hometown fans. And never did Flair or his horsemen look more like total idiots than during the Nitro that took place on September 1, 1997. A week earlier, the Nitro in Columbia, South Carolina had destroyed all previous ratings records, thanks in part to Raw being preempted for the U.S. Open tennis tournament, doing a 4.97 rating for a show built around area legend Arn Anderson's announcement of retirement due to serious neck surgery. The plan for the following week was pretty straightforward. The show would be presented as a tribute to Arn, but halfway through, the NWO was going to do a skit making fun of Arn's tremendous speech the week before. All the fans would be outraged. Then, at the end of the skit, the horsemen would run out and clean house as Anderson stood, smirking, on the ramp. This never happened. Instead, the NWO did the parody, and there was no retaliation, as Nash got the whole horseman run in at Nixt. Flair, outraged, refused to go out for an interview later, saying it would kill the horseman off even more to do so without having attacked the NWO earlier. Arn was so upset, he nearly quit the company, not so much because of the content of the skit, but because of the fact that his family watching at home was devastated by it. The skit touched on Arn's alleged alcoholism, and his reaction to this was made worse by the fact that his mother had died of the disease when he was very young. The parody set up Fall Brawl, which took place deep in the heart of Flair Country, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Before a crowd of almost 12,000 rabid horseman fans, Flair was once again booked to take the loss, as new member Kurt Hennig, who had been nominated by Arn as his horseman replacement just weeks earlier, turned on the group and gave yet another win to the New World Order. At this point, it was beginning to appear that no one could ever compete on even ground with the NWO. Bischoff didn't care about the backstage squawking of men like Flair, since business was going through the roof. Nitro, which at the beginning of the year was averaging ratings in the low threes, was suddenly and consistently in the fours. The September 8 show was a huge success, doing a 4.27 to Raw's 2.15, the biggest margin in history up to that point. Shows were selling out left and right. The weekend of September 4 was the first in history in which the company grossed over $1 million on house show revenue alone, and pay-per-view buy rates were climbing. Halloween Havoc in particular was a massive success, despite the fact that the show was headlined by yet another horrendous Piper Hogan match, the third in the last 9 months. It drew a gigantic 1.1 buy rate, drawing 12,457 fans and a $297,508 gate. On the bright side, the Rey Mysterio Jr. Eddie Guerrero mask versus title match, which Rey won, although he had been scheduled to lose until just minutes before the show started, was WCW's best match of at least the past 5 years. As good as business was for that show, the next pay-per-view, World War III, was even better, drawing 17,128 fans and $407,831 at the gate. Who the hell cared about wrestlers pissing and moaning when WCW was making this much jack? Not only were they making money, but Bischoff was about to stumble upon yet another success, one that would ensure the health of WCW for years to come. Bill Goldberg. The former Atlanta Falcon turned power plant trainee debuted on the August 22nd Nitro in a 2-minute and 24-second win over Hugh Morris. Afterwards, he simply held up a single finger as if to say, "That's one." He didn't say a word, and in fact wouldn't for almost a full year after his debut. By the time the show was over, most had probably forgotten the match. Ironic, given that he'd soon become one of the company's most unforgettable stars. WCW had everything going for them, and it was about to get even better. Bischoff would soon sign the hottest free agent in the history of wrestling, and when he did, it would no doubt be the final nail in the coffin of Vince McMahon and the WWF. Although Bischoff had amassed the greatest array of talent the wrestling world had ever seen, there was one guy he'd been after for years and had been unable to get. Bret Hart. Bischoff had badly wanted to bring Hart in during the summer of 1996. He knew that if he could somehow grab not only Hall and Nash, but also Hart, it would truly appear that every top star from the WWF was coming to WCW. Unfortunately for Eric, McMahon was able to convince Bret to stay and signed him to that 20-year deal mentioned previously. There were a lot of questions regarding that contract. Most specifically, how could McMahon afford to pay it? Bischoff knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the WWF was in severe financial straits. The company had lost $6 million in 1996, and things weren't looking to improve that drastically for 1997. Pushing WCW castaways like Steve Austin and Mick Foley, who had been unceremoniously discarded by Bischoff himself, he figured that WWF didn't stand a chance. As if he needed more proof to support his theory, the rumor mill had once again began to rumble about problems developing between McMahon and WWF champion Hart. Those rumors were confirmed when Hart, with the blessing of McMahon himself, contacted Bischoff to see if the possibility existed to accept the contract he declined a year earlier. Bischoff no doubt trembled with glee as Brett told him the story. McMahon claimed he could not afford to pay the promised monies to Hart. In fact, Vince had told Brett that the company was in, quote, financial peril. In Eric's mind, this translated to Bret Hart is once again a free agent, and the WWF is dead. This was a joyous moment for Bischoff. By signing Hart, not only was he getting one of the greatest pro wrestlers of all time, but he was also taking away one of the few remaining WWF draws. Just as he had been able to do with Nash and Hall, he would leave fans' jaws on the floor by bringing Bret to Nitro. After all, he wasn't just a huge star for the WWF. He was their world champion, for God's sake. At this point, Bischoff realized that as bad as he thought things were going for Vince, they had to have been much, much worse than even he could have ever possibly dreamed. One of the provisions of Bret's 20-year contract with the WWF was that he had reasonable creative control of his character. Therefore, as champion, he had the right to decide whom he would lose the belt to and when he'd do so. For months, a very real rivalry had developed between Bret and one of McMahon's other favorite performers, Shawn Michaels. Michaels, who also had a great deal of power backstage, seemed to take delight in pissing Bret off at every turn. One time, he even went so far as to allege, on air no less, that Bret was in the midst of an extramarital affair with popular WWF diva Sunny. This infuriated Hart, not to mention his wife, and it led to an infamous backstage fight between the two men that ended with Shawn temporarily quitting after a huge chunk of hair was pulled out of his scalp. As Bret's WWF contract approached expiration and his WCW debut loomed ever nearer, he and Vince began to discuss scenarios to get the title off of him. The next WWF pay-per-view was the Survivor Series in Montreal, and Vince suggested that Bret should drop the strap to, you guessed it, Shawn Michaels. Shawn had first won the belt from Bret a year earlier in a 60-minute Iron Man match at WrestleMania, and injuries, both real and fake, fights and other problems, kept the big rematch from ever taking place. At first, Bret exercised his creative control and refused, stating that he'd rather, quote, blow his brains out than lose to Shawn. One of his main gripes was that several weeks earlier, Shawn had told both him and McMahon that he wasn't going to do any more jobs to anyone else in the promotion, and that included Bret. If that was going to be Shawn's attitude, Bret figured he'd just return the favor and refuse to lose to Shawn. On the Wednesday before the Montreal Survivor Series, Vince called Shawn up and once again asked if he'd lose. Shawn got to talking about it with his good buddy Hunter Hearst Helmsley, and Hunter was appalled, arguing that Shawn would be a fool to agree to lose to a guy who was on his way over to the competition. So Shawn called Vince back and said losing the match was a no-go. As soon as Bret heard that, he said if Shawn wasn't going to lose to him in Montreal, then he wasn't going to lose to Shawn anywhere under any circumstances. A few days later, Bret changed his mind. That Friday, his lawyer sent the WWF a letter stating that Bret was willing to drop the belt to anyone in the company as long as it didn't happen in Canada. Since his WCW contract didn't start until December 1, there were several places where he could lose the belt, including the house shows the following week in Youngstown, Ohio on November 13th, in Pittsburgh on November 14th, or at Madison Square Garden on November 15th. And he said, if Vince wanted to do it on pay-per-view, he'd drop the belt in a four-way at the December 7th show in Springfield, Massachusetts. Vince noted that Bret's WCW deal started on December 1. Bret said that wasn't a problem, and convinced Eric to hold off on his WCW debut until December 8. Upon hearing this, Vince said, fine. Bret would win via DQ, thereby not making Shawn look bad, in Montreal, then lose the belt in a four-way in December. But then, Vince changed his mind again, saying word had gotten out that Brett was leaving, and it was therefore imperative that he lose the title before Nitro the night after Survivor Series. After all, Vince reasoned, even though Brett couldn't show up on Nitro until after December 1 for legal reasons, if Bischoff went on TV and even mentioned that he'd signed away his champion, the WWF would be dead. Brett said he'd call Bischoff and get him to hold off on the announcement. Unfortunately, Eric was off hunting in Wyoming, and Brett couldn't reach him. Vince suggested he drop the belt at the house show in Detroit the night before Montreal. Brett again refused, saying that the match between himself and Michaels was too big to trivialize, and that to do it right, he had to go into Montreal as the champion. If Vince wanted him to lose it later that week at a house show, he reiterated, that would be fine. Sunday was fast approaching, and nobody could decide on a finish, which had Brett on edge. Vince argued that it wasn't fair for him to refuse to lose. Brett said it was fair, as Vince himself had put the creative control clause in his contract. They argued about what the, quote, reasonable part of reasonable creative control meant. Finally, just hours before the pay-per-view, they met backstage. Vince asked Brett what he wanted to do. Brett said he wanted to leave with his head held high, and then, the next day on Raw, he'd vacate the belt, and, without burying the company, i.e. making Vince or the WWF look bad in any way, he'd tell the fans that he was leaving. Vince acquiesced, and the plan was set for Shawn to lose via DQ that night when D-Generation X, Shawn's group, and the Hart Foundation, Brett's group, ran in. During the match, Shawn put Brett in Brett's own finishing maneuver, the sharpshooter. Brett was told beforehand that he would reverse the move, which would lead to another series of near falls. This never happened. Instead, referee Earl Hebner, a longtime close friend of Hart's who had actually sworn on his children's lives before the show that he wouldn't fast count him, simply called for the bell. The timekeeper, who wasn't in on what was going to transpire, was initially confused about what to do. Thankfully, McMahon himself came down to ringside to offer the following helpful advice. Ring the fucking bell! And so Shawn was now the champion, and Brett, as he'd later state countless times, was screwed. It became known as the most famous double cross in wrestling history. Brett had been with his former employer for 14 years, missing only two shows in that time, and he'd done everything he could to help the WWF. Callously, they turned their backs on him. It was a moment that would live forever in the minds of all those who saw it, a memory reinforced by the footage replayed over and over on WWF television in an effort to make fans believe that Vince had done the right thing. This should have helped WCW, since Brett was about to be all over both programs and hurt the WWF, which had blatantly screwed over a very popular star. But the wrestling business is a uniquely peculiar world. As it turned out, McMahon, who really just hoped the whole story would die, having no desire to play a major on-screen role, suddenly became the biggest heel on WWF television. This ultimately led to an everyman versus every boss feud between him and the company's biggest babyface star, Steve Austin. This rivalry turned out to be a springboard for the company's fortunes, which subsequently skyrocketed to the point that Vince became a certifiable billionaire. And what of Bret Hart? Heading into WCW with such momentum, it seemed absolutely impossible that the company could somehow screw this up. There was no question that something huge would be lined up for Bret come the next big pay-per-view blockbuster, Starrcade. Spoiler alert! Bret Hart, years later, would have this to say of his WCW tenure. What does make me angry is how poor WCW used me. They couldn't have done a worse job, and the scary thing is that they were paying me. All I can say is that it was like a lunatic asylum. I think of Eric Bischoff, who I like as a person, and I sympathize maybe with whatever he was going through. But Eric Bischoff was a lot like that wizard in The Wizard of Oz. He really had no idea what he was doing. They never came up with one idea for me, and any time I came up with an idea, it was usually turned away. It was the most screwed up place I ever worked for. Bischoff counters, when Brett got to WCW, he was not the Bret Hart we'd watched in the WWF. I think the incident with Vince McMahon took a tremendous toll on him. Or perhaps Brett never really felt at home in WCW. You can have the best written screenplay with the best director, the best soundtrack, the best supporting cast, and if your lead actor doesn't feel the part, chances are that movie is never going to be what you want it to be. I think in some part, that was the problem with Brett. Regardless of how we used him, there was never the passion and the commitment to the role that could propel him. As you read through what WCW gave Bret Hart to work with, we will let you, the reader, decide if he was given Gone with the Wind or Ready to Rumble. Spoiler alert, we may have just given that away too. But prior to that event, Bischoff had something else to take care of. He decided to try doing another show entirely based around the NWO. Apparently nothing had been learned from the sold-out fiasco in January, so serious thought was now being given to handing Nitro over to Hogan and his heel contingent. In early 1998, plans were on the drawing board for a two-hour Thursday night show on TBS, and Bischoff's grandiose idea was to eventually split the company so that there would be a WCW show and an NWO show, thereby making the WWF, get ready, because he really believed this, the number three promotion in America. Thus, NWO Nitro got a trial run, with results that were either shockingly disastrous or shockingly predictable, depending on your viewpoint. The show opened with the NWO B-Squad's arrival, and their immediate demand that the production crew tear down anything with the WCW logo on it. Every sign, every banner, even the gigantic metal WCW were all laid to waste. In their place were custom-designed NWO Nitro banners and set pieces. Just to show that this wasn't designed as a one-time shot, a spiffy new video package opened the show. Everyone involved was to be aligned with the new world order, from the wrestlers to the announcers, right down to the ring crew. Although the entire group glad-handed each other and went on about how wonderful they all were, the night truly belonged, of course, to Hulk Hogan. The majority of NWO Nitro was less of a wrestling show than it was a celebration of the life and times of Terry Bollea, complete with a 20-minute segment in which Bischoff gave Hogan presents, like giant banners and motorcycles featuring his image. He even dropped down to one knee and placed a ring in the shape of the WCW World title upon his finger. It looked for all the world like he was going to propose to the Hulkster. Although all this posturing no doubt pleased Bischoff and Hogan, those watching at home didn't share the love. With the Starrcade, set to deliver arguably the best promoted match in the history of the company just days away, you'd have thought that this Nitro would have drawn incredible ratings, possibly the highest ever for the company. Not only did that not happen, but the show actually dropped almost a full point from its average, and the original plan to air NWO Nitro on a weekly basis was permanently scrapped. The elaborate sets, the shirts, the video production, it all amounted to nothing more than a colossal waste of money. To Bischoff, though, it was just a failed experiment. Sure, they had lost a few bucks on the sets, and the ratings had sagged slightly. But wasn't it worth the risk? What if it had worked? And really, what did it matter? The biggest show of the year, Starrcade, was coming up. And it was the one show that every single wrestling fan in the country was going to line up to see. Not only would Sting versus Hogan finally happen, but Bret Hart would also be making his first ever appearance on a WCW pay-per-view as a special referee for an Eric Bischoff-Larry Zbysko match. What? In a move that was puzzling to, well, everyone, including Bret himself, the hottest commodity in pro wrestling was not going to appear as an in-ring competitor, but rather as a referee. The bout between Zbysko and Bischoff was to determine the fate of Nitro. Should Larry win, Nitro would remain under the control of WCW. If Bischoff took the bout, the world would be rewarded with NWO Nitro each and every week. The big question leading up to the match was whether Brett would side with the NWO or with WCW. In other words, Bret Hart, the man who was WWF champion until less than 2 months earlier, the man the company was paying almost $3 million a year, the man who had just competed in the most shocking and noteworthy bout in decades, was nothing more than a pawn in the never-ending WCW versus New World Order battle. It was the start of what would be a long, confusing tenure for Hart in his newfound home. Much of Hart's difficulty had to do with career politicians like Hogan and Nash, who played Bischoff like a fiddle, getting out of doing jobs to protect their spots high atop the card. And when Bischoff wouldn't cave in to their demands, they'd simply take their ball and go home. Such was the case at Starrcade, when Nash was scheduled to take on, and lose to, the Giant. However, that afternoon, Nash, suffering from indigestion, called the office and said that he seriously believed he'd had a minor heart attack. Nobody backstage believed the story, since Nash had been saying he wouldn't lose to the Giant for months, and it had become a running joke. Fans instead saw Scott Hall trash-talk the Giant. Then he took a chokeslam during an interview. Yes. Not only did Nash get out of doing the job, but the obvious replacement match, featuring Hall against the Giant, also didn't take place. Shockingly, or not considering the men involved backstage, almost none of the NWO members lost their matches at Starrcade. Even career scrubs like Mike, Vincent, Virgil, whatever Jones, went over top WCW guys like the Steiners. Lex Luger, WCW champion just 4 months earlier, wound up on his back for a three count in a losing effort to Buff Bagwell. It was all very strange because this had been built up as the ultimate WCW revenge show, the show in which the New World Order would finally get their comeuppance from the good guys. In fact, one of the only bouts in which the NWO was defeated was in the co-main event of the evening, the Bischoff-Zabisco contest. Yes, on the biggest pay-per-view in the company's entire history, Bischoff booked his match as one of the main events. To show he was a team player, however, he wound up losing when Hart decided to side with WCW, thereby saving the world from repeated viewings of NWO Nitro. And even in that match, Bischoff wasn't pinned, nor did he submit. Brett just kind of awarded the bout to Zabisco due to, well, no reason in particular. It could, of course, be argued that all of the goofiness on the show really didn't matter, because at the end of the day, the fans were really there to see the match WCW had been building for over a year. Sting versus Hogan. Sure, those fans may have been let down by the evening's proceedings, and maybe they'd even lost some faith in WCW. But it didn't matter, because now, finally, Hulk Hogan would get his ass kicked by Sting. However, this being Hogan, that didn't happen. Hogan strutted down the ramp in his usual cocky manner, playing the air guitar and eventually ambling over to confer with Nick Patrick, the evil referee assigned to the bout. The two chatted for a moment in a manner far removed from the standard overt pantomimes of the wrestling business. In fact, it almost looked as though Hogan and Patrick were double-checking to make sure they had certain spots laid out within the match itself. Weird. After having descended from the rafters in a breathtaking manner for the better part of the past 18 months, this time, Sting simply walked down the aisle, stopping to glance at the crowd momentarily, then resuming his journey. He then slowly climbed into the ring. It was as if this were just another run-of-the-mill match on another run-of-the-mill show. Nick Patrick stood between the men and explained the rules. Hogan and Sting locked eyes, and then it happened. Hogan shoved Sting. Sting responded by slapping Hogan in the face. It was on. Hogan slowly circled Sting and the two locked up. The crowd came to life, chanting, "Hogan sucks!" It was obvious they were desperate to see the Stinger KO this arrogant asshole once and for all. And the crowd kept waiting for that to happen. And waiting. And waiting. And it never happened. In fact, Hogan began to dominate the bout, with Sting only scoring a few minor moves here and there. A headlock spot was worked for over 2 minutes as the life began to drain from the crowd. Hogan took Sting outside the ring and worked him over, throwing him into the guardrail and then choking him out with his boot. He threw Sting back in, cupped his hand to his ear as he had done so often in his career, and bounced off the ropes, landing his signature finishing move, the leg drop of doom. Hogan covered Sting. Patrick dropped down and started his count. 1 2 3 Sting didn't kick out. Nope, he did not kick out. The man who had stalked Hogan and his evil band for over a year had just failed miserably in a match 1 year in the making. Patrick raised Hogan's arm in victory as the once rabid crowd sat in stunned silence. The WCW announcers scrambled for an explanation. They claimed that Patrick had issued a fast count and that Sting hadn't really lost. Problem was, it wasn't a fast count. For years, it has been debated what happened in this match. How can you screw up the biggest spot of your career, the pivotal fast count in the biggest match in the history of WCW? Did Patrick just forget? Did he get a double top secret payoff from Hogan to do a normal count so as not to make Hogan look bad? What happened? For whatever it's worth, Patrick's claim was, get this, that although in hindsight it was a perfectly normal three count, at the time, he thought he was counting really fast. Yeah. Following the phantom fast count and the perfectly clean defeat of Sting at the hands of Hulk Hogan, Bret Hart ran down to ringside and grabbed the ring announcer. Over a muffled house mic, Bret claimed, "This isn't going to happen again," in reference to the infamous Montreal finish, where he himself had been screwed out of the WWF title. Most in the crowd didn't even hear what Hart had said, and they looked angry and confused. And Sting, the savior of WCW, was still flat on his back in the ring. After a brief skirmish, Hart flattened Patrick and tossed Hogan back into Sting, who had finally come back to life. Sting nailed Hogan with a Stinger splash, then he locked on his finishing maneuver, the dreaded Scorpion Deathlock. The crowd waited for Hogan's hand to slap the mat, the so-called tap out that would signal his submission. It didn't come. And instead, Bret Hart told the timekeeper to ring the bell, the story being that Hogan had said, "I quit," a fact that no microphones picked up. The belt was awarded to Sting as WCW wrestlers filled the ring in a joyous celebration. And as the wrestlers and the fans celebrated, so did Bischoff. All his hard work, all his patience, it had all paid off big time. Starrcade 97 was, without question, the biggest moneymaker WCW had ever produced. 17,500 fans, a $543,000 gate, an incredible 1.9 buy rate, meaning nearly $6 million in revenue, and the beginning of the end. I read somewhere if something is working, don't try to fix it. Our ratings are high, our arenas are selling out, we can't keep merchandise in inventory. You're right. There must be something wrong with Nitro. Eric Bischoff to a fan, asking why Nitro was so repetitive in a Prodigy chat, April 17, 1997. Chapter 4, 1998, Momentum is Money. The March 9, 1998 edition of Monday Nitro was the ninth consecutive sellout for World Championship Wrestling. In addition to those nine sellouts, the company had already sold out the following 11 shows in advance as well. Never before had they sold out 20 venues in a row. That was not the only good news. Business, as compared to 1997, was through the roof. Attendance in January averaged 8,023 paying fans per show, an increase of 49% from the year prior. Gates averaged $157,019 for the month, an increase of almost 150%. At the sold-out pay-per-view in January, which drew just a 0.47 buy rate the year prior, pulled a 1.02, an increase of over 173%. That, of course, meant a revenue increase of over 173% as well. The company was skyrocketing. However, the lesson of the year was not learned until much later. Sadly, many in wrestling have yet to learn it to this day. The lesson is that when things are hot in pro wrestling, promoters can do no wrong. Booking can be horrible, matches can suck, storylines can make no sense, TV shows and pay-per-views can be letdowns, wrestlers can be falsely advertised, and none of it matters. Because it's hot, fans are going to spend money on the product. Of course, any damage done during this period eventually takes its toll, but to promoters who live only for Tuesday morning Nielsen television ratings, the only thing that matters is the moment, Unfortunately, a few years later, WCW would learn the other half of this lesson. When things are bad, promoters can do nothing right. There's always been a theory that the wrestling business is cyclical. A superstar or an act takes off and gets incredibly hot for a period of time, then things cool off, and eventually things get really hot again. It seems that no one ever has bothered to stop and ask why. It has just been accepted. Today, the explanation is fairly obvious to anyone outside the wrestling industry. First, a wrestling star catches fire. There is not necessarily any rhyme or reason as to how or why this happens. Sometimes a guy comes along and the company knows from day one that he's going to be it. The Rock was a perfect example of this. There were WWE officials who predicted that he would be the biggest star in our business by the year 2000 after his very first professional match. He actually beat that estimate by a couple of years. There are also guys nobody saw coming, who got over because they just happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right gimmick. Stone Cold Steve Austin, probably the biggest star in wrestling history in terms of drawing money, was a good example of this. If a star really takes off, he could turn an entire company around. In fact, Austin turned the World Wrestling Federation around to such a degree that they went from losing $6 million in 1996 to grossing $456 million a few years later and going public, making Vince McMahon a legitimate, honest-to-God, evil billionaire. But as the old saying goes, nothing lasts forever. Eventually, even the brightest star starts to cool. There is absolutely no avoiding this. Sure, he might still be popular, and if he's a big enough star, like an El Santo in Mexico, he may become iconic. But he's not going to sell millions of dollars worth of tickets and pay-per-view buys forever, especially against the same old foes he's wrestled 100 times before. Worst case scenario, if he's pushed too hard for too long, the fans may actually turn against him, making him more of a liability than anything else. In a perfect world, the company would use the still super-hot star to create another huge superstar, a successor of sorts. Unfortunately, too, do this correctly, the successor has to be booked in such a way that he appears to be a true successor. That means he has to win a lot of matches, and eventually, decisively beat the big star. Perhaps you can see the dilemma. Promoters have rarely been able to bring themselves to replace their bread and butter before it's too late. They see him making extraordinary amounts of money for the company, and they cannot fathom tinkering with the formula in any way. Lesson not learned. Or is it? One need only look at the John Cena era of WWE in recent years to see this situation. He is the biggest star the company has, a true ratings and merchandise mover, and thus, there is a natural tendency to avoid changing a status quo that is proven to be a moneymaker. It has led to a product that many fans feel is stale, yet the company views as safe. The idea to do something different with Cena, such as turn him heel, has been bandied about for years, but is always rejected due to their need to maintain the status quo, and their fear of losing their largest merchandise mover. In many ways, wrestling promoters are notoriously short-sighted. As noted earlier, they live for the moment, for the sound of the cheering crowd, for the following day's ratings, for the next buy rate. They don't have the long-term vision to see that unless things stay fresh, the decline in fortunes can be just as swift, and sometimes even faster, than the ascent. There is an old saying, popularized by Bret Hart in Paul Jay's excellent documentary Wrestling with Shadows, that promoters ride a wrestler like a horse until he can't go anymore. Then they put a bullet in his head. Inevitably, they ride that horse until he's long past the point of drawing big money. And then, when things start to decline, they panic. The panic breeds inept and hotshot booking. The decline speeds up, and it finally gets to the point where the company is so cold that in the eyes of the fans, it can do nothing right. Of course, to those inside the wrestling business, especially those who have booked their promotions into a cold period, this is absurd. Wrestling is simply cyclical. There's no reason for it. And if there is a reason, well, it certainly has nothing to do with anything they have or have not done. Once the decision was made to create Nitro to go head-to-head with Raw, Eric Bischoff created a winning formula that helped the company take off. He put huge marquee matches, such as Hulk Hogan versus Lex Luger, on free TV to build the audience. He bought all the big-name talent available and put them on TV as often as